This is VOA 1.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Pete Musto, Susan Shand, John Russell, and Alice Bryant. Later, you will hear Transients in Arcadia by O. Henry on American Stories. But first, here is Pete Musto.
People living in New York City are fearful after facing the worst of the coronavirus health crisis. This fear is fueling a sudden increase in home sales and rentals around the small towns and wooded hills to the city's north. Anil and Joyce Lilly will not be staying in their Bronx apartment much longer. They just bought a house north of New York in the Hudson Valley. It takes about an hour to reach from the city. We were locked into the apartment for 3 months, a solid 3 months, Joyce Lilly told the Associated Press, explaining their move to Washingtonville, New York. I feel like I'm getting out of prison and I want to run as far away as possible, she said. Property sellers describe an active market recently, with many house hunters able to work from home. Stephen Domber is president of Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Hudson Valley Properties. He said a large number of the home buyers are coming from Manhattan, in the heart of the city. Many of them are experiencing cabin fever, which is wanting to get out of an apartment and having some land if there's a lockdown again, he said. The Catskill Mountains and parts of the valley north of the city have been long-time vacation spots for New Yorkers. But agents say sales and rental activity is far above normal. Domber said his June sales were up about 30% compared to the same month last year. Home builder Chuck Petersheim said he took 8 orders in 1 month, compared to his usual 1.5 each month. But New York City is in no danger of losing a lot of people anytime soon. The movement north only represents a small part of the city's population of 8.3 million. New homes in the area cost from under $200,000 to more than $1 million. They are an escape many people cannot afford. But the increase in sales and long-term rentals suggests many New Yorkers see the city as less livable. Susan Cohen rented a home in Rhinebeck, New York, with her husband after sheltering in their Upper East Side apartment. She said, "For 6 weeks in our 2-bedroom apartment, all we talked about was without a vaccine, we will never go on the subway again. We won't go to the movies. We won't go to the theater. And we said, what are we living here for?" County-level home sales numbers from May and June still show a decrease compared to last year. But agents say those numbers are the result of delays of 1 to 3 months between offers being accepted and closings on home sales. Agents have described recent bidding wars over homes that had been on the market for some time, and new listings being bought quickly by buyers with cash. realtor John Murphy said some homes are selling for $100,000 or more above their asking prices. Home hunters Tony Speciali and Jeremy Marcini learned about competition recently when they walked through the front door of a home in Kingston, New York. At that same moment, their agent got a message from the seller about a cash offer from someone else. I'm Pete Musto.
Some companies in the United States want to know how they can make their workplaces safer. Industry healthcare experts say companies are worried because of information from the world's top public health agency. About 2 weeks ago, the World Health Organization called for more scientific study of the airborne transmission of the new coronavirus. It is the cause of the disease COVID-19. Experts say if the virus can stay in the air for long periods of time, it raises safety questions for people in offices, stores, and other workplaces. The possibility that the virus can spread through the air in this way has not been included in U.S. government rules for returning to work. Many companies have created rules based on information from the WHO that says drops of fluid with the virus could infect people after they landed on surfaces. Now there are questions about whether the virus can survive in very small drops that stay in the air for hours. Companies are wondering whether their policies on face covering and improving airflow are good enough. Some stores have put in glass barriers between employees and customers. Now, experts say they must decide what to do if the virus can stay in the air around their employees. Neil Mills is the chief medical officer at Healthcare Services Group, Aon. He began receiving questions recently about the WHO's decision to investigate airborne transmission. He said employers were slowing the return of workers back to their offices. They are doing due diligence around how are you going to reduce the transmission of the virus if it is airborne, Mills said. The slowdown comes as some employers have already begun delaying plans to bring back office workers because of the rising number of coronavirus cases. Energy industry companies Halliburton in Texas and California-based Chevron are among them. Employers are asking if public health guidelines asking that individuals remain about 2 meters apart and wear masks are enough. They also wonder about air cooling systems that do not have filtration devices and the effectiveness of the glass barriers against an airborne virus, said David Zeig. Zeig is an expert at Mercer, a healthcare services company. Experts are telling employers to go beyond their existing plans. Plans may include measuring people's body temperature, asking health questions, and cleaning restrooms more often. I'm Susan Shand.
British scientists say they have solved a mystery involving Stonehenge, the world-famous stone monument in Wiltshire, England. The scientists reported this week that they have identified where many of Stonehenge's large stones, called megaliths, came from. Thousands of years ago, people used such stones to build markers, monuments, and other structures. The researchers said part of one megalith helped solve the mystery. The small piece of stone had been kept in the United States for over 40 years. Chemical testing suggests that most of Stonehenge's megaliths, known as sarsens, came from an area called West Woods. It is about 25 kilometers away from the ancient monument, the researchers said on Wednesday. People set up the sarsens at Stonehenge over 4,000 years ago. The largest sarsen is 9.1 meters tall. The heaviest weighs about 30 tons. David Nash of the University of Brighton led the study, which was published in the journal Science Advances. Nash said that researchers still do not know how people moved the stones to Stonehenge. Given the size of the stones, they must have either been dragged or moved on rollers, he said. Nash added, "We don't know the exact route, but at least we now have a starting point and an end point." Stonehenge also has smaller stones, called bluestones. Experts believe these stones came from Pembrokeshire in Wales, around 250 kilometers away. A sarsen core sample, taken during repair work in the late 1950s, gave important information about Stonehenge's origins. The core sample was given to a man named Robert Phillips. Phillips worked for the company that was repairing the monument. Phillips took the sample with permission when he moved to the United States in 1977, Nash said. Phillips returned it to Britain for research in 2018. He died this year. The researchers studied very small pieces of the sample to find where it came from. It was similar to sandstone found at West Woods and all but two of the Stonehenge sarsens. Nash said he hopes the finding will help people better understand the hard work that went into building Stonehenge. I'm John Russell.
This week, we answer several questions about how to use the verb do. Jem in Turkey wants to know what do means when used before a present tense verb, such as in the statement, "You do bring up a good point." Jean-Claude in Belgium wants to know why a learning English writer put does before the verb restrict in a statement about Trump and student visas. Issa in Mali wants to know what it means when we use do in statements like, "I do have something." And a Maori in Brazil wants to know why we might use do in a statement like, "I did spend too much time." Hello, Jem, Jean-Claude, Issa, and Amaury. All of your examples have one thing in common. They use the verb do in positive statements. You probably know that do can act as a main verb or an auxiliary verb, depending on how it is used. Your examples use it as an auxiliary verb, also known as a helping verb. When do is a helping verb, it helps us do many things, such as form questions, as in, do you play football? Give short answers, as in, yes, I do. Make negative statements, as in, I do not play football. And give negative commands, as in, do not play football. We do not normally use the helping verb do in positive statements, such as, I play football. However, we can use it in such statements to show emphasis. For instance, suppose someone was not sure about whether or not you play football. You might make the answer clear by saying, I do play football. Or suppose your friends were saying they play basketball, but you play a different sport, football. You might say, I don't play basketball, but I do play football. Use of do in the positive statement, I do play football, makes the point stronger and clearer. Similarly, in the examples you asked about, the helping verb do was used to give extra emphasis to the positive. In speaking, when we use do in this way, we say it a little louder than the words around it. Listen again. I do play football. In writing, we sometimes italicize the word to show the emphasis. That's Ask a Teacher for this week. What questions do you have about English? Send us an email at learningenglish@voanews.com. I'm Alice Bryant.
Transients in Arcadia. There is a certain hotel on Broadway that is very pleasant in the summer. Not many people have heard about it. It is wide and cool. Its rooms have walls of dark wood. There are green trees around it and soft winds. It has all the pleasures of mountain living and none of the pains. You will eat better fish there than you could catch for yourself in the streams and hills. You will have better meat than a hunter brings home from the forest. A few have discovered this cool spot in the hot summer of New York. You will see these few guests eating dinner in the hotel restaurant. They are happy to be there, and happy to know that they are very few. They feel especially wise because they have found this delightful place. More waiters than necessary are always near. They bring what is wanted before anyone asks for it. The pleasing distant noise of Broadway sounds like running water in a forest. At every strange footstep, the guests turn quickly and look. They are afraid that the restless pleasure seekers will find their hotel and destroy its pleasant quiet. And so these few live during the hot season. They enjoy the delights of mountain and seashore. All is brought to them in their Broadway hotel. This summer, a lady came to the hotel giving this name.
Madame Louise d'Arcy Beaumont.
The name was like a name in the story of a great romance. And Madame Beaumont was the kind of lady the Hotel Lotus loved. She was beautiful, and her manner was very fine. Everyone wished to serve her. The other guests believed that, as a guest, she was perfection. This perfect guest did not often leave the hotel. In this, she was like the other guests of the Hotel Lotus. To enjoy that hotel, one needed to forget the city. New York might have been miles away. At night, sometimes one might go out, but during the hot day, one remained in the cool shade of the Lotus. Madame was alone in the Hotel Lotus. She was alone as a queen is alone because of her high position. She rose from bed late in the morning. She was then a sweet, soft person who seemed to shine quietly. But at dinner, she was different. She would wear a beautiful dress. I cannot find words fine enough to tell about it. Always there were red flowers at her shoulder. When the head waiter saw a dress like this, he met it at the door. You thought of Paris when you saw it, and of the theatre, and of old romances. A story about Madame Beaumont was told among the guests in the Hotel Lotus. It was said that she was a woman who had travelled all over the world. It was said that she knew the most important people everywhere. It was said that in her white hands she held the future of certain nations. It was no surprise, they said, that such a lady should choose the Hotel Lotus. It was the most desirable and the most restful place in America during the heat of summer. On the third day of Madame Beaumont's stay in the hotel, a young man entered as a guest. His clothes were quiet, but good. His face was pleasant. His expression was that of a man who had travelled and could understand the world. He said that he would remain 3 or 4 days. He asked about the sailing of certain ships. He seemed to like this hotel the best of all he had known. The young man put his name down on the list of hotel guests. Harold Farrington. It was a name with a fine sound, and the young man belonged perfectly in the quiet life of the Lotus. In one day he became like all the other guests. Like them, he had his table and his waiter. He also had the same fear that the wrong people might suddenly discover this hotel and destroy its peace. After dinner on the next day, Madame Beaumont dropped something as she passed Harold Farrington's table. He picked it up and, following her, returned it. He spoke only a few quiet words as he did this, and she was pleased by his good manners. She knew that he was a gentleman. Guests of the Lotus seemed to understand each other very easily. Perhaps it was the result of having discovered this Broadway hotel. Guests felt sure that only especially fine people would enjoy the cool delights of the Lotus. Now, very quickly, a sudden friendship grew between Farrington and Madame Beaumont. They stood and talked for a few moments.
"I have seen too much of the usual summer hotels," said Madame Beaumont, with a small but sweet smile. "Why go to the mountains or the seashore? We cannot escape noise and dust there. The people who make noise and dust follow us there."
"Even on the ocean," said Farrington sadly. "Those same people are all around us. What shall we do when they discover the Lotus?"
"I hope they don't discover the Lotus this week," said Madame. "I only know one other place I like as well. It is the beautiful home of a prince in the mountains in Europe."
"The best people," said Farrington, "are seeking for the quiet places like this one, where they can escape the crowds."
"I promise myself 3 more days of this delightful rest," said Madame Beaumont. "The next day, my ship sails."
Harold Farrington's eyes showed that he was sorry. "I too must leave then," he said. "But I am not sailing for Europe."
"We cannot stay here forever, though it is so delightful," said Madame Beaumont. "I like it better than my usual life, which is too full of people. I shall never forget my week in the Hotel Lotus."
"Nor shall I," said Farrington in a low voice, "and I shall never like the ship that carries you away." On their last evening, the two sat together at a little table. A waiter brought them something cool to eat. Madame Beaumont was wearing the same beautiful dress. She seemed thoughtful. When she had finished eating, she took out a dollar.
"Mr. Farrington,"
she said with a smile that everyone in the Lotus loved,
"I want to tell you something. I am going to leave early tomorrow morning because I must go back to work. I work selling women's clothes at Casey's shop. That dollar is all the money I have. I won't have any more till I get paid at the end of the week. You're a real gentleman, and you've been good to me. I wanted to tell you before I went. For a year I've been planning to come here. Each week I put aside a little of my pay so I would have enough money. I wanted to live one week like a rich lady. I wanted to get up in the morning when I wished. I wanted to be served by waiters. I wanted to have the best of everything. Now I've done it, and I've been happier than I ever was before. And now I'm going back to work. I wanted to tell you about it, Mr. Farrington, because I thought you liked me, and I liked you. This week I've told you many things that weren't true. I told you things I've read about. They never happened to me. I've been living in a story. It wasn't real. I wanted you to think I was a great lady. This dress I'm wearing, it's the only pretty dress I own. I haven't paid for it yet. I'm paying for it a little at a time. The price was $75. It was made for me at O'Dowd and Levinsky's shop. I paid $10 first, and now I have to pay $1 a week until it's all paid. And that's all I have to say, Mr. Farrington, except that my name is Mamie Siviter, and not Madame Beaumont. Thank you for listening to me. This dollar is the dollar I'm going to pay for my dress tomorrow. And now, I'll go up to my room."
As Harold Farrington listened, his face had not changed. When she had finished, he took out a small book and began to write in it. Then he pulled out the small page with his writing on it and gave it to her, and he took the dollar from her hand. "I go to work, too, tomorrow morning," he said, "and I decided to begin now. That paper says you've paid your dollar for this week. I've been working for O'Dowd and Levinsky for 3 years. Strange, isn't it? We both had the same idea. I always wanted to stay at a good hotel. I get $20 a week. Like you, I put aside a little money at a time until I had enough. Listen, Mamie, will you go to the pleasure park on Coney Island with me on payday?" The girl who had been Madame Eloise d'Arcy Beaumont smiled.
"I'd love to go, Mr. Farrington. Coney will be all right. Although, we did live with rich people for a week."
They could hear the night noises of the hot city. Inside the Hotel Lotus, it was cool. The waiter stood near, ready to get anything they asked for. Madame Beaumont started up to her room for the last time. And he said, "Forget that Harold Farrington, will you? McManus is the name. James McManus. Some call me Jimmy."
"Good night, Jimmy."
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.